people at the oil companies are in a panic. You know, they can't be this lucky forever. They need to get these leaks stopped or they're in trouble.
An Alaskan reporter investigates the Gulf Coast oil spill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 5th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, finding ways to help the workers who have one of the toughest jobs in Alaska.
There's at least one case where a health aide walked in cold on a scene of a suicide of an immediate family member.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A ship carrying a 100-ton containment box is heading to an oil leak site in the Gulf of Mexico to try to cover the flow of crude and funnel it to a tanker. The contraption will then be lowered about 5,000 feet below the water's surface. Meanwhile, crews are burning patches of the slick. Anchorage reporter Craig Medred is in Mississippi, reporting on the Gulf disaster for AlaskaDispatch.com. As a longtime Alaskan journalist, he also saw firsthand the destruction from the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. He's in Gulfport, Mississippi today and plans to drive to Alabama tomorrow. Medred says it's hard to underestimate how different this disaster is from the Exxon Valdez.
It's almost like some people here, especially some in the media, are wishing for the spill to hit because they've really seen nothing. I mean, the closest they've come is this kind of sheen which has hit the very tip of the Louisiana Peninsula, what you might describe as like marsh gas if you've ever been in a swamp and seen that kind of sheen on the water. But the oil itself, this all started 50 miles offshore, and so far they've been incredibly lucky that they've been able to contain it there, and they've bombed it pretty heavily with dispersants, and the wind has cooperated, and so far, there's really no there.
And Craig, tell us a little bit about the differences between oil spilled in cold water conditions, such as when the Exxon Valdez spill happened in Prince William Sound, as opposed to where you're at right now, where, as you said, it's 90 degrees.
It's 90 degrees. The oil itself, I'm told, I'm no expert on crude oil, but the oil itself, it's told, is what they call light Texas crude, which is a much thinner oil with a lot more volatiles in it, benzene and other very evaporative chemicals. So it isn't as sticky as ours. The big problem, I don't know if you remember what the Exxon Valdez, but the crude itself is fairly thick, but it at the temperature and in the conditions, it quickly bonded to water and formed what was called mousse. And it was very difficult to deal with because you couldn't even skim it. It would gum everything up. And this oil is not at all like that. If they get to it quickly, it's pretty burnable because it has a lot of volatiles in it. And if they don't get to it quickly, dispersants, which are really just, you know, a fancy version of a detergent, work a lot better because, as with all chemical reactions, heat helps. It's like, you know, what if you're closing hot water instead of cold water? And in the case of the Exxon Valdez, they were trying to wash the clothes in very cold water, and dispersants didn't help much at all. So they have better tools to fight this, and it's pretty impressive how successful they've been so far. Now, whether they can keep doing that, I think the people at the oil companies, the Coast Guard, NOAA, and everyone are in a panic that they, you know, they can't be this lucky forever, that they need to get these leaks stopped or they're in trouble. It's, and in that respect, it's kind of like an Apollo 13 situation where you've got a bunch of engineers running around trying to figure out a solution to this problem and a bunch of other people just spending their time worrying with not much happening.
Craig, what's happening with that oil? Is anyone talking about the fact that it's being dispersed? They're using dispersants, but that doesn't mean it's magically disappearing. It's going somewhere.
Well, it's sort of like the dirt in your washing machine. When you wash your dirty clothes, it goes somewhere. The question is where. I talked to a couple different microbiologists yesterday, one at the University of Louisiana and one at the University of Louisiana Lafayette, and they're of the opinion that there's quite a culture of oil-eating microbes in the Gulf of Mexico because of past oil spills, because of all the tanker traffic that goes through here and pumps its bilges and dumps oil, because of so much oil And they're, you know, they're of the opinion that as this breaks down, those microbes will feast on it and pretty much recycle it into the nutrient system.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to fishermen? Do they have ideas yet about how fisheries may be impacted?
They're all very worried. They're worried, as fishermen always are, first and foremost, about how they're going to make a living. I don't think they have a big concern. I mean, a lot of the fisheries here, it's shrimp fisheries, it's nearshore fisheries that they don't operate out where they do operate sort of out where the oil is. But I don't think there's a great fear among fishermen about the long-term impacts of the oil as long as it stays offshore. I think they're in a panic at the idea that it might get inshore and into Louisiana marshes, where it could be really, really hard to get out and would affect, you know, nursery areas for shrimp and crab that are a big part of the economy down here. I think they're very afraid of that, and they're just, I mean, generally fearful, as you would be, that, you know, your life could be destroyed or changed. They're sitting on the beach. There's not much they can do. I mean, they're trying to get involved in putting out boom. We saw in the Valdez how ineffective boom could be in certain situations. And they're scared, which is a normal human reaction, and that is, for most people, something difficult to deal with because there's really nothing they can do. I mean, but be afraid. There's not much proactive they can do. So that's a very, very troubling thing, no matter what your profession is.
Craig Medrid is reporting on the Gulf of Mexico oil spill for Alaska Dispatch. Health aides in the lower Yukon village of Nunum Iqua resigned in protest weeks ago, citing concerns about their own safety. Temporary aides were put in place during a 2-week law enforcement crackdown in the village. That stint is now over. But new plans are forming to address the crisis and prevent others from occurring. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
After the high-profile resignations, the Association of Village Council Presidents placed 2 village public safety officers in Nunum Iqua, and the Alaska State Troopers placed an officer there as well, Trooper Lieutenant David Tracy.
And I think that had a positive impact on the community as a whole. And moving forward, things started to quiet down significantly.
But Tracy says troopers don't have the resources, statewide or regionally, to maintain a presence in the small village. That work typically goes to village public safety officers. But until now, there's been no one willing to serve in Nunum Iqua. Tracy says that may have changed after their visit.
We were able to identify a couple candidates, perhaps, for our VPSO program. That's pending. We're hopeful that we can identify somebody and get somebody working there.
Until a permanent presence is in place, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is providing care through a sub-regional clinic located over 20 miles away in the village of Imanuk. Bill Schreiner is YKHC's health aid director.
Health aides or mid-level providers there will triage over the phone and make a determination if that's someone who they'll direct to get on over to Imanuk to be seen for something more, you know, more minor, something not life-threatening or too debilitating. Or they might work with the family for Medicaid travel to get them into Bethel or to Imanuk by air.
YKHC says they'll send a small staff to open up the Nunum Iqua clinic when troopers make day visits. But Schreiner says health aid burnout is not just a problem in Nunum Iqua.
Most people familiar with health aides have a great deal of respect and appreciation for them. But there's kind of a hidden aspect to what goes on out there in a lot of locations.
As the only available healthcare professional in sight, Schreiner says that it's not uncommon for people to demand too much. YKHC is now developing a new program aimed at improving relations between aides and the communities they serve. He talks about one example where a health aide was on medical leave. Meanwhile, someone else was demanding medicine, and in the middle of the night, the health aide obliged.
This particular health aide told me they wouldn't stop calling me until I went in. So they drug themselves in to get pain reliever. They went work through their pain and their suffering when they weren't supposed to be working to get Tylenol for someone.
Full training for an aide costs an average of $200,000. Resignations are not only costly, but can have serious effects in the villages they served. On top of the social pressures, aides are often traumatized by the unique nature of their jobs. Many of the worst cases they see can involve friends or family.
There's at least one case where a health aide walked in cold on a scene of a suicide of an immediate family member, and with no forewarning, nobody being able to tell them ahead of time what they were walking into. They just knew that they were needed. And you know, how can you wrap your mind around that? How can we really understand what it's like for a health aide to deal with that kind of trauma?
Few can, except those that have already gone through it. Schreiner says that YKHC is implementing a conference for new health aides. It will be led by others that know the burden.
Folks who were fantastic in this job for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, men and women who figured out how to maintain their lives and be a health aide long-term in their villages.
Schreiner says YKHC hopes to implement that pilot project this summer. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Voters in Bethel have rejected a ballot initiative to once again bar the sale of alcohol there. The results are unofficial, but according to the Bethel City Clerk's office, 57% of voters said no to returning to damp status at the special election held yesterday. Ballot sponsors were hoping to undo the results of the previous election when voters revoked 30 years of local option alcohol restrictions. There are still questioned and absentee ballots to be counted, but nearly all of those votes would have to be yes to change the election outcome. The vote means that Bethel residents can continue to import alcohol without restrictions. Businesses and organizations can continue to apply for liquor license. So far, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board rejected all the applications. The special election was the third time in 8 months that Bethel has voted on alcohol. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage teachers give tentative approval for a tentative contract.
As of right now, I'm going to vote for it, and I'm pretty happy with it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Three former top administrators with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game have written a letter to Governor Sean Parnell warning that Sea Alaska's land selection bill could lead to an Endangered Species Act listing for the Queen Charlotte goshawk and the Alexander Archipelago wolf. Wayne Reglin, Matt Robus, and Ron Somerville are all former wildlife conservation directors. Reglin and Somerville are also former deputy fish and game commissioners. They say if the species are listed, it would cause severe economic problems for Southeast Alaska. Robus says the U.S. Forest Service has successfully kept the two species off the list by creating old-growth reserves in the Tongass National Forest. He says those protections would disappear if Sea Alaska is allowed to choose old-growth stands to complete its land entitlement under the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Both have been proposed for either threatened or endangered status, and both have been found by the federal government to not be threatened on the basis largely of the conservation strategies that have been put in place, mostly through the Forest Service's land use management plan, because, of course, most of that land that's being talked about is in the Forest Service's jurisdiction.
Robus says if the species were listed as endangered or threatened, it could mean the end of logging in Southeast.
There's a bunch of land selections that result in logging in some of the areas that the conservation strategy is counting on to be unaffected habitat. It could potentially lead to other listing efforts. And if those were to result in listing, there'd be pretty substantial impacts to any sort of economic development activity in Southeast.
Robus says the three former officials want Sea Alaska to get its land entitlement.
In that letter, we talked about supporting Sea Alaska getting the acreage that it was promised, wherever those come out of, is the question.
The federal government owes Sea Alaska about 85,000 acres, but the company is seeking congressional approval to select land outside the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act boundaries. Governor Parnell hasn't responded to the letter. A federal judge in Anchorage has decided in favor of the Forest Service and against two environmental groups in a 2008 lawsuit over the impacts of logging on deer habitat. Both sides agree the implications go beyond the four timber sales named in the suit. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
In his April 28th decision, U.S. Court Judge Ralph Beislein upheld the way the Forest Service had assessed deer habitat in its approval of four timber sale plans on the Tongass National Forest under the 1997 Forest Plan. Greenpeace and Cascadia Wildlands Project claimed the agency violated its own forest-wide plan and federal environmental law. Among other allegations, the groups alleged the agency had incorrectly used a scientific model and overestimated how many deer a patch of forest land can support. Larry Edwards is with the Greenpeace office in Sitka.
The Forest Service made an error in applying the science in using a conversion factor with the results from its deer model. And that conversion factor is applied in order to assess impacts to sustainability of wolf populations and providing adequate deer over time for subsistence hunters. And the Forest Service made a very significant error in how that multiplier is used.
The Forest Service has since changed its methods for estimating deer habitat in the 2008 revision of the Tongass Land Management Plan. Edwards sees this as tacit admission that the Forest Service had been wrong before, and he points out the agency has never gone back to reanalyze and correct the decisions made under the old plan. However, in his ruling, Judge Beislein found that the Forest Service's earlier application of the model, quote, represents a bona fide scientific disagreement with the plaintiff's position, rather than simply an error. Edwards says his organization expects to appeal the ruling in the Ninth Circuit Court. He thinks the issue goes beyond the four sales named in the suit.
In 2008, we did ask the Forest Service to go back and do supplemental analysis on all of these timber sales that still have timber available from them that have been done since 1997 to correct these errors in the modeling and look at their analysis again, and the Forest Service hasn't done that.
With the recent court ruling in its favor, the Forest Service is not planning to go back and review those sales anytime soon. Forrest Cole is supervisor for the Tongass.
Well, there is potential for that, but and every time we go back and do new analysis on old projects, it has a tendency to cost a significant amount of time and energy, not to mention the money. So I think the ruling that we have will suffice for now that what we've done is adequate.
Cole sees the court decision as significant for several reasons.
Probably the most significant is because we've had this issue over our deer model for quite some time, either through appeals or separate lawsuits, is that the analysis that we're doing is valid, and the work that was done specifically for these projects is a legitimate method of determining what those effects might be.
There has been little to no timber offered or purchased from the projects named in the suit. They include the Overlook and Scott Peak sales near Petersburg, the Soda Nick sale on Prince of Wales Island, and Trader's Cove near Ketchikan. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Fairbanks is still waiting on GreenUp, a somewhat subjective technique. Observing a green hue of the trees on Chena Ridge is used to officially designate the GreenUp date in Fairbanks. The technique has been employed by National Weather Service meteorologists to track GreenUps in Fairbanks since 1976. The latest leaf out recorded during that time span was May 26, 1992, and the earliest May 1, 1995. Eugenie Yuskirchen, an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology who tracks GreenUp, says buds have burst, but their progression to leaves has stalled due to recent cooler weather. Yuskirchen says Fairbanks is trending toward earlier greenups, which she attributes to warmer temperatures and earlier meltouts.
If you plot the line, it does actually show a trend towards an earlier leaf out in the later years here. Probably, I would say, is related to earlier snow melt and earlier warming in the spring.
Yuskirchen says an early greenup means leaves start absorbing carbon dioxide earlier. She says that's a negative feedback to climate warming, but nowhere near the benefit that solar reflectivity from longer-lasting snow cover provides.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Trans-Alaska Pipeline stakeholders are meeting this week to discuss citizen oversight. The Copper River Watershed Project, a Cordoba-based environmental group, is hosting a public meeting in Glen Allen today with government and industry representatives in hopes of establishing a citizen watchdog group for the pipeline. The organization would be similar to the federally mandated and industry-funded Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council that monitors tankers' activities. Oil industry analyst and Copper River Watershed Project consultant Richard Feinberg says there are significant issues along the pipeline that could benefit from public scrutiny.
We need the citizens' oversight because of the well-known discrepancy between promise and practice in environmental compliance on PAPs due to cost-cutting pressures from the owners.
Feinberg says citizen involvement could improve understanding of pipeline operations.
That can be very constructive for both the industry and the government oversight people to have an informed entity to tell them how they're doing rather than an uninformed public reaction.
Environmentalists have long pushed for citizen oversight of the pipeline, but it's never been mandated by government, and the oil industry hasn't been willing to buy in. Alyeska Corporate Communications Director Michelle Egan says the company feels there's already a lot of opportunity for public involvement through the regulatory process.
We want to make sure that people are exhausting the opportunities that they have right now to be engaged and to learn more about the pipeline and to comment on our spill plans and our readiness.
Feinberg says current concerns about industry oversight that have arisen due to the Gulf of Mexico oil spill could elevate the issue. He says Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich have in the past expressed support for a citizens oversight group for the pipeline. Tomorrow, Anchorage teachers vote on a tentative 3-year agreement with the Anchorage School District. On Monday, members met with their bargaining team and union board to ask questions and voice concerns about the proposed contract. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The 5 p.m. meeting took place at Change Point Church. Anchorage Education Association members started to arrive about a half hour earlier. Most were reluctant to speak to the press, but not all. Andy Holeman of Golden View Middle School felt the current economic situation had restricted contract negotiations, and future economic trends will make the agreement unsatisfactory.
Well, certainly we all wish we were in different economic times, and when you look at it, you can't avoid thinking about that. If you do the math on it, I think in 3 years, teachers will be a little worse off in terms of buying power under this contract. I suspect it won't quite pace inflation in Anchorage.
If a majority of the approximately 3,500 members approve the agreement, the 3-year contract raises the base salary for a new teacher with a bachelor's degree by the 2012-2013 school year from $43,000 to $47,000. The highest paid teachers, those with a PhD and long experience, would increase from $80,000 to about $86,000. Holeman is not backing the tentative agreement.
I'm pretty sure I'll vote against it. It's not bad. It's not a terrible agreement. I don't think it's good enough, and I'll be disappointed when it passes, but that'll be okay.
Third grade teacher Chrissy Neff is more positive about the tentative agreement.
As of right now, I'm going to vote for it based on, I think, after they went back to the table after the school board meeting, some good things came out, and I'm pretty happy with it.
My name is Les Hayden. I'm a science instructor at East High School. There's nothing perfect, but to me anyway, this sounds like a pretty good deal, and I think it should go the way it is.
Hayden's reserved acceptance was fairly typical of AEA members willing to comment. There are parts he doesn't like, but the agreement's salary portion is acceptable, given the economy and the mood of the community at large.
I think they're within the realm of everybody else and other districts. I think we can feel fortunate. I've heard some districts, especially down the 48, that are getting rolled back or getting no increases whatsoever. So, plus they're laying off and making class sizes bigger.
According to an AEA handout, besides raises, the tentative agreement includes increased district contributions to health insurance premiums, added duty payments for elementary school teachers, 3 more days of automatic emergency leave, and health insurance benefits for some part-time AEA members. Compared to similar informative meetings in the past, attendance was lighter than in years when the contract negotiations had gone through arbitration and the talks turned bitter. One elementary school teacher was reluctant to give her name, but she did say she'd been with the district 8 years and appreciated the improved tone of the negotiations that had marked the tentative agreement.
This one seems a lot less stressful and better, but that's why I'm here tonight. I want to see what other concerns other people have found and bringing up, and then seeing where to go from there. Just informational tonight.
So your vote could still swing?
Yes. Yep.
AEA members will vote whether or not to accept the tentative agreement this Thursday. The association will announce the results Friday morning, first to the members, next to Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como, and then to the media. If AEA ratifies the tentative agreement, it then goes to the Anchorage School Board for approval on May 24th. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. Volunteer firefighting is a rewarding and extraordinary way to serve your community. It takes dedication, sacrifice, leadership, as well as mental and physical stamina. Emergency calls throughout Alaska continue to rise, but the number of volunteer firefighters continues to decline. Learn how you can experience the excitement and satisfaction of becoming a volunteer firefighter. Visit asfafireline.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska State Firefighters Association. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.